This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Wall Street is not what it used to be. I mean, sure, if you visit the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, you're still going to see a mob of people manically waving their arms and shouting. But increasingly, computers dominate trade. More than 50% of the action on any given day is performed by a computer. And computers give investors an edge. They can analyze information and execute decisions at the speed of light. And that ability has opened up a new world for the Wall Street gamblers. Stock market enthusiasts say it's a good thing, helps keep the market running smoothly. But critics say the speed and complexity of these trades are too intense and they create some serious problems. So today we'll talk about the brave new world of computerized trading. With us now, Richard Warr. He's a professor of finance in the Poole College of Management at North Carolina State University. Richard, welcome. Good to have you here.
Yeah, good to be here.
Tell us how computers are changing and sort of the impact they're having just generally on Wall Street. How are things changing?
Well, it used to be the case that individuals would make decisions to buy and sell, and they would send those orders into the exchange, and then those orders would go down to a couple of guys on the floor who would wave their hands at each other, and these trades would go off. But probably since 10, 15 years ago, with the advent of computers becoming more cheaper and more powerful, people started programming computers to actually execute these trades on their behalf. Fast forward to today, and now we have massive data centers, massive computer centers located adjacent to stock markets, which are basically running these algorithms that submit tens of thousands of trades per second to the markets, trying to capitalize on any perceived mispricing of any security, and trying to reap fractions of pennies or pennies profits. But doing this so fast and so quickly that at the end of the day, they're making a lot of money.
So they can do – fraction of a penny, but they can do it quicker than this whole floor trading thing. So speed. So that's what the computers give us. They do things faster and it's cheaper, right, because you've got computers, not people.
It's very cheap, yeah. But I think that these trades couldn't be done by people. It's not a matter of making people unemployed. You just couldn't do it. I mean, we're talking trades that are going off in hundreds or thousands or ten thousandths of a second.
Well, and of course, the algorithm is if this, then that. If you notice this, any kind of disparity, anything that looks a little odd to you, buy low, sell high.
Obviously, buy low, sell high is the basic idea of all investing. But these trading algorithms will actually be a bit more kind of strategic than that. What they'll do is they'll actually, for example, submit a lot of quotes out into the marketplace to purchase a security, and then hoping to entice some large trader to respond to those quotes, and then they'll pull them all back quickly once that large trader has effectively tipped his hand that he wants to sell, say, a large block of stock. And whenever you sell a large block of stock, that's a downward pressure on prices. And so then the high-frequency traders will then come back in with new sets of orders to basically capitalize now that they know which way the direction of the market is going.
So let me understand this. You can do this. You could say, I just might be interested in X stock at this price. I mean, maybe. And then you put up your hand and I can actually pull it back. So I'm not actually – this is not a firm offer yet that the computer sent
you. In the same way that you can put a classified ad out there, saying that I would like to sell or buy something, you can put quotes out there. And in fact these high-frequency traders will put, literally tens of thousands of quotes, hundreds of thousands of quotes, of which none will get executed. None will actually result in a trade. But what they're looking for is the way I think of it is that it's like a big pond, and they know there's a big fish in there that they want to try to trade with. And if they can figure out the direction that fish is going, it will tell them which way the market's going. So they put in hooks all over the pond. And as soon as they get a nibble on one of those hooks, they pull the hooks out and then they then implement another trade or another strategy that's going to profit on that direction.
But the effect of their feeler was to actually lower the price, because now you've sort of outed yourself and the whole market now knows your intention.
Right.
So that's kind of interesting in the sense that now, because of the velocity and the volume that these trades, you can actually have an impact on prices. You can change things to your benefit.
But we're talking probably in a small range. I mean, you're not going to move the stock price $10. You know, we're talking pennies here. That would probably happen anyway with somebody making a large trade. It will have a small impact, a kind of a price impact on the level of the stock.
But this has had an impact on the market, the so-called flash crashes in the past few years. Describe those for us and what happens.
Well, the flash crash, you know, is partly attributable to high-frequency traders. But, you know, it happened back in May of 2010.
Right.
A lot of uncertainty, concerned about Greece. And at the time, when there's a lot of volatility in the market and a lot of uncertainty in the market, this is prime hunting ground for high-frequency traders. They like stock prices to move around a lot. So there's a high number of high-frequency traders in the marketplace, issuing quotes, withdrawing quotes, and less actual kind of what you might think of investment traders in the marketplace. And what we saw was there was some sudden fluctuation in the stock price. We're not really sure why that occurred. And when that happens, if things don't behave in the way that the high-frequency trading algorithms predict, they will withdraw all the quotes. So all of a sudden, they all leave the marketplace. And now there's a dearth of traders in there. And then you have this very unusual thing called a stub quote, which is basically where a market maker, somebody who's trading, will issue two quotes, one which is a quote that they want to say buy at, and that might be and then the quote they want to sell at. And so perhaps the quote they want to sell at is $50, but they really don't want to buy the stock. So they say, well, I'm going to put a buy quote in it at a penny, okay? And they've no intention of using that quote. But when everybody else pulls their quotes away, these stub quotes become revealed, and that's how Procter & Gamble goes to a penny. And then within a few seconds and a few minutes, it bounced back. So a lot of this is due to, you know, quoting systems, the presence of these high-frequency traders, and then the fact that they can leave the market in a hurry, and also what we call the fragmentation of the market. You know, it's incorrect to think of the market just being, for example, the New York Stock Exchange downtown in Manhattan. It's multiple markets all over the country. Some are electronic, some have different structures. And so this is a very fragmented market where one stock could be traded in many, many different venues.
So I think we've listed a couple of the perceived advantages. It's faster. You can get a lot more done in the course of a day. There are these ways of reaping a profit on based on volume. Quarters of pennies really add up if you're doing hundreds of thousands and millions of trades. And it's cheaper. We don't have to have the fees and all the other things associated with each trade. Any other advantages?
I mean, from a retail investor – So a retail investor is somebody like you or myself, somebody who's trading small shares. The high-frequency traders are great because they basically mean that you will trade against them and you will get instant execution. You'll be able to say, I want to sell my 100 shares at Walmart, and it will go off immediately. The other benefit of having these kind of traders in the market is that they provide information and they correct mispricings in the market. So although it's counterintuitive, you think you have more people speculating, actually more people studying, throwing resources at a stock to try to figure out what its correct price is will actually produce a better pricing outcome.
Even when they're, in a sense, manipulating the price with these little in-and-out tricks?
Yeah, I think so. I mean the high-frequency traders can cause small levels of volatility. So we're talking very short periods of volatility. But aggregate market level volatility, for example, the swings you see from day to day, is not really attributable to high frequency traders.
How about the downside? What do we have to worry about?
The downside is crashes. The downside is, I think the other example is a big high profile story recently with the Knight Trading example, Knight Capital, where this is a large company that basically trades a lot of stock. It's a market maker, has a very big presence in the market, and they had a computer glitch. I mean, it was simply a bad piece of code, and their computer went haywire and basically submitted random trades for 30 minutes. And in that time, Knight lost $400 million and almost faced bankruptcy. The big question everybody asked was, why on earth didn't they pull the plug? And apparently they sat around and I don't know the full story, but they sat around and watched it for 30 minutes or so. But the issue is, well, what happens if a major financial institution has a trading program run amok, they lose massive amount of money, and then this has a knock-on effect.
Right, for the rest of the market.
For the rest of the market.
And you talked about individual traders. So if I'm the E-Trade guy and I'm doing this stuff, then this kind of high-volume buying works for me. What about my 401k? What about other sort of larger investors?
For larger institutional investors, they are in a battle with the high-frequency traders. The larger institutional investors, for example, in your 401k, maybe you have money in Fidelity, you may have a mutual fund in Fidelity, and they want to buy some Walmart today. They need to buy a big block of Walmart, and the high-frequency traders are looking for those guys. Those are the big fishes. And because they want to buy a big piece of Walmart, they're revealing information about what they think about Walmart. They think Walmart is a good buy, and maybe it's going to go up a little bit. And so if the high-frequency traders can figure out what they're doing and get ahead of them, they can profit from that information. So effectively, the institutions are doing the work, figuring out that Walmart is a good buy, we should buy it today. And the high-frequency traders are trying to interpret their trades and are reacting. This costs us, I think, in individuals indirectly in terms of the returns that we receive on our mutual funds will be slightly lower because of this deadweight cost.
They jumped ahead of us. We did the research. They got the jump there faster.
And it also means that our mutual fund companies have to now invest significant amount of money in trading resources in order to effectively outwit these guys.
On the State of Things today, we're talking about computerized trading and how it's changing the stock market and investing. Richard Warr, our guest, he's a professor of finance at the Poole College of Management at North Carolina State. Just ahead, we'll take a deeper look at all of the trading that's going on in Wall Street. You'll do it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about how computers affect Wall Street. The speed and complexity of the programs make some people nervous, and yet it gives others an advantage, and it certainly does do some good things on Wall Street. With us, Richard Warr. He's a professor of finance at the Poole College of Management at North Carolina State University. Joining us now is Mike Aguilar. He's a lecturer in the economics department at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Mike, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Alex Arapoglu is a professor of practice of finance at the Kenan Flagler Business School at UNC, and he is also with us. Alex, welcome back. Good to have you.
Good to be here, Frank.
So you've heard this conversation so far, and I'll ask you, because you were a trader at one point. You were a human being, and you remain a human being, but no longer a trader. Happy to say. Is there a difference? The algorithms theoretically are programmed, they're written to pick your brain. They do theoretically what you would have done. What's the difference between a human, apart from speed, obviously?
Yeah, I think, as a trader, you're always trying to see what the prices of substitutes are, what the prices of other things are, and they give you some insight. So, you know, for example, if the price of silver is going up, that probably the price of gold will be going up with it. And so you try and take advantage of these relationships in order that the prices that you put forward, particularly as a market maker, are logical, and you don't put forward a price that's too high so that everybody sells to you or too low so that everybody buys from you. What a computer can do is look at a broader set of substitutes and a broader set of relationships, and it can calculate what those relationships ought to be and then make sure that whatever price comes out of that is consistent, and most importantly, that it's fair, that it's in a relative sense, so that when I go in as an E-Trade customer, I won't end up losing 0.25% or 1% simply because I picked the wrong day.
So does that mean, these trades are essentially math. That's the language and the logic of all of these trades. And computers, that's what they really do well. So are they fundamentally better than people with doing this? Yeah.
Well, in many ways, they're fundamentally better than people. But, you know, there's a downside. So if you're using any form of numerical analysis or any type of algorithm, could come up with the right price. But if somehow the algorithm fails and starts hunting, you could end up with random types of prices. The other issue, I think, which is important to consider here, is, of course, Knight, which you referred to earlier, had some programming errors and ended up losing more than $400 million in the space of about 45 minutes. That's something that could be tested one-off if there's enough time. But what's hard to do is to see what the interaction effects are of many competing software products. You can imagine what happens. You decide to buy based upon a correlation. The correlation deteriorates even further. So at that point, you decide to sell. But not only you, every other computer out there that's using the same math, and then you have some sort of vicious spiral starting.
Well, Mike, it also raises the question, what happens when you do figure all that out, and instead of allowing your computer just to follow the herd, you've actually programmed it to maybe push the computers in one direction deliberately and then say, let's go the other way. In other words, is the fact of these algorithms, the fact that we know what the programs do and mm-hmm. we're less certain about the human beings, if that's true, mean that it's more ripe for manipulation? Somebody can really figure out how to push the market in a direction using a program.
Oh, certainly. I think a lot what we've seen is a redistribution within the marketplace. There's a change of wealth transferring from liquidity takers to liquidity makers on the system, from the slow-moving mutual funds that we heard before up to the high-frequency traders. And a lot of that, I think, is because of the regulatory structures, loopholes that are in there, and the high-frequency traders using their technology to take advantage of that.
So what about that, about regulation? Is the SEC keeping up? And is there anything that we need to keep up with? Is there any difference in the way you would regulate these trades because of the volume? Let me ask you that question, Richard.
I mean, the SEC is years behind, really, because the technology moves so rapidly and there is so much money being spent on this. I mean, you know, we're laying lines underneath the Arctic Ocean so that we can speed up trading with Tokyo right now. I mean, there's huge dollar amounts being thrown at this. I'm not sure what the correct regulation is, but it's perhaps not clear to me that going to decimalization and fractions of decimals in terms of pricing has necessarily helped directly. Mm. I think once you allow stock prices to be priced in ever smaller increments, then you increase the offsetting effect is more trading.
I mean, is there any? Do you need to regulate the speed of this? Let me ask you, Alex, and then Mike. Does that help, or is that, you know? Well, forget about whether or not you want to, or Wall Street would like it, or the.
I think one thing we should talk about is the information advantage. So we all know that insider trading is a bad thing. And then, of course, insider information is no longer insider information when it's public information, because then everybody's on a level playing field. At the moment, the exchanges sell preferential access to other types of information, what orders are there, what prices have recently transpired. So in that sense, some people have information that other people don't have, and that puts them at a disadvantage. Just as an earnings number, having an early release of an earnings number might put someone at a disadvantage. The same way, knowing that, for example, something sold at 49, well, you should no longer be willing to pay 50 for that if the last sale was at 49. So I think that's something that needs to be regulated, an effort to put everybody on a level playing field so that they receive information at the same time.
Reg NMS, the National Market System, which was instituted by the SEC in 2007, was passed in 2005, implemented in 2007, attempted to do that. But just like the tax code, there's a ton of loopholes that the high-frequency traders are exploiting, which I was mentioning before. One of which that we were talking about earlier is this high not slide order, which is an artifact of a rule, one of the pieces of the NMS regulation, saying that if the market gets to a point where it's locked, that's a particular manipulation of the system, if it's locked, it has to unlock. How does it unlock? A particular order slides down, which means it reduces the price, and the person who put in that order actually loses their place in line. Now, the high-frequency traders didn't quite like that. So the venues, which are supporting them and make all their money off of them, create a new order types, one of which is this high not slide. What that allows them to do is place an order that's hidden, so therefore it doesn't violate Reg NMS and doesn't violate the locked marketplace. And then they can be ahead of the line when the market starts to clear again. They can create all sorts of great strategies about this, like diabolicals.
Well, is this only something that's possible because of high-volume computerized trading?
No, it's a response. There used to be, let's say, three basic order forms. You would have a limit order, and that meant I want to sell, for instance, mm-hmm. at 100. You'd have a market order. I'll sell at whatever price is available. And you could have stop-loss orders. I will sell once the price goes below a certain level. But as the high-frequency trading developed, there was a desire to have other forms of orders, and this mm-hmm. hide-not-slide was one of them. The disadvantage of it is one, again, that goes to fairness. Not everybody is treated alike. Let's say you're the first person in an auction to say, I'll pay 100. The last thing you want is someone to say, well, I'll match his price and have priority over you. Mm. The exchanges were designed in such a way that you had time priority as well as price priority. If you were the first person to step up to the plate, you would get the order. But with hide not slide, there's the opportunity for people through a computer to jump ahead of the queue.
And proximity is also another freakish quality here, in that we would think that with digital technology, it didn't matter where you were on the planet to do these trades, but it turns out because of the speed of light, and we won't get into that in detail, that actually if your computer is physically closer to the exchange, you actually have an advantage.
Correct.
Can you explain that?
We're dealing in microseconds, milliseconds in fact. An ultra-high-frequency trader is trading under 1 millisecond. So that's 1/1000th of a second. Just to put that in perspective, it takes 300 milliseconds to blink your eye. A really fast human trader, 500 milliseconds. That's the proxy for it. So the computer systems, the fiber optic cable, can only transfer at that speed of light, and you run into those frictions. So we have now direct market access, DMAs, where you're co-locating the servers to be able to jump off of the speed of light.
And you can literally, like, they've done experiments so that if you're at the wall closest right. to the exchange and in the same office 50 feet away, the guy at the wall gets the advantage and gets the jump on it.
And the solution to that, that's a real problem. The solution was the exchanges that encourage this co-location require everybody to use the same length cable.
So they did fix that.
They fixed it. It doesn't matter where you are in the room. They measure the cables. Everybody has to use the same length cable because literally an extra 5 feet on the cable will make a difference.
And there's also ways to kind of cheat the system, Mike. And you were talking about some of those in which just disrupting communication is enough to give you a jump.
Yeah. You know, it seems as though the marginal benefit of the speed wars is beginning to decline. You know, we've seen evidence from TradeWorks, one of the main firms, saying they're dedicating less of their resources to fighting the speed war. They're fighting a different war in terms of making the algorithm smarter. What I'm worried about is a different tactic where it almost becomes criminal in nature. So you can disrupt communications. You can create criminal activities in the finance world. You can tap into fiber optic cable so you can do information reconnaissance. You could have targeted EMPs. You could have GPS spoofing.
Targeted EMP would be a what?
Well, there's two which are in the atmosphere right now.
What's an EMP?
EMP stands for electromagnetic pulse. Mm-hmm. The GPS spoofing, the GPS is probably more familiar to everybody. Mm-hmm. That's like in the iPhone or car navigation system. You have a venue and you have a trader. And they have to be on the same time scale, down to the microsecond like we were talking about before. If they're off, then whoever is off is at a disadvantage. A GPS spoofer or an EMP would disrupt that communication, disrupt the GPS signal, put them off by a microsecond or so, giving whoever is doing that a marginal advantage. These are criminal activities. The SEC right now is trying to plug loopholes in their legal structure, but there's a possibility for illegal activity as well, which would not be within the SEC's purview. That's FBI.
Right. And the SEC did try to do this, but you have to help me through this because when I read it, I couldn't believe my eyes. The SEC actually hired a company that writes the programs that do the trading and said, you know, we need to monitor this. Would you guys come over here and help us write a program that would help us monitor the programs that you write for these other people? And by the way, when you go back, don't tell them anything about the security system. This is like hiring Bonnie and Clyde to install your alarm system, right? I mean, am I right? I'm sorry to get excited about this. Have I gone too far? Have I missed the point here?
I don't think that the SEC is going to be able to productively regulate this activity. But the part of the problem is there's so much money tied up into it. There's so much money involved in high-frequency trading, but also all the exchanges like this. they make money out of this. This is their bread and butter now. It's all that volume. So there's too many people who are involved in making it work, and basically perpetuating this kind of technological arms race.
But I'm right about that. They did hire that company.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You were about to say something, right?
No, I was actually going to inquire. Was that UBS and their light pool? UBS has their light pool now? Is that the one to which we're referring?
I don't know.
No,
okay. UBS has a light pool, which is the antithesis of the dark pool, where a lot of these high-frequency traders hide out. And the light pool is meant to use the same type of hunter-seeker-type algorithms that the high-frequency traders use to detect them. So one of the rumors has been the SEC was going to use that type of technology that's implemented in the light pool to protect others to be able to detect and deter them.
Yeah, well, and maybe you can explain that. Let's hope we can do this. But there are these dark pools. There are places that where trades take place that are not transparent to the rest of the market. Explain why that would be a benefit, why we would allow these things, and the impact they have, and whether or not computerized trading has any effect on these.
Well, I think the word that you used, impact, is appropriate. They're trying to hide price impact. Richard was discussing this in part earlier about transaction costs. If I'm a large block trader, I don't want others, including the high-frequency traders, to see my order and take advantage of it. So how do I place an order without people knowing I'm doing so? The dark pool is a way to do that. It's a separate exchange where not all of your order size is actually known to the public.
Well, I thought transparency was the main thing when it comes to a stock exchange in terms of being able to regulate. Are these regulated? Dark pools, are they regulated?
They're under the SRO, so the self-regulated organization.
Self-regulated. They do so well with that.
But their bids, their quotes have to be posted, and their quotes have to follow the NMS system.
Correct.
And these have been around for a long time, dark pools, or are they a function of, are they generated by?
5, 10 years.
Yeah, I'd say a decade or so, yeah.
So what's the relationship to computerized trading, high volume trading? Anything? Does it matter, or is it coincidental?
The high frequency traders will go fishing in these dark pools, as such, you know. And so on one hand, you know, the makers of the dark pools will promote them to the institutions, say, hey, you can unload your big trades here without anybody knowing. But on the other hand, then they'll turn around to the high frequency guys and say, hey, I got a well stocked pond here, and you know, you should guys can run your trading algorithms here as well. So there is they're playing both sides of the game.
In terms of information technology, Mike, is it true that actually now we're developing programs that can now read text and do that kind of analysis?
Oh, certainly. Actually, some of my research is about that exactly. They're referred to as text analytic services. Reuters, Dow Jones, RavenPack, they have these types of services. What it allows you to do is move beyond the human capabilities of information processing. If I'm an analyst, I need to read the newspaper. On any given day, there's on maybe Microsoft, at least 100 news stories an hour. In order for me to be able to process that, it's impossible. So I need to have a machine to be able to do that. These type of text analytic services will read through an article, conceptualize that, and turn it into a numerical metric. And once it's a number, then the machines can use it. And the latency is, you know, 0.2 of a second by the time it hits the newswire to the time it gets to your desk to be able to feed into your machines and create a trading strategy.
Wow. So you can actually build a program that says stay plastic enough to change according to the new information. And you're analyzing these hundreds of documents. So it's all pretty fast, but it also strikes me as being very vulnerable. It strikes me that if I'm the bad guys and I was the enemy of the market, I could write a program that could crash you in a minute now that I know how the trick works. No?
I don't think so. I think that because there are so many participants in the market, and it's not just one big high-frequency kind of HAL, you know, computer running everything, if one computer goes off kind of and starts sending trades in the wrong direction, everybody else will jump in to correct it. So I think it makes prices more efficient as long as there's not some kind of cataclysmic effect on all the traders. But I think as long as there's other participants still working, the market remains pretty efficient.
Well, the big issue is if everybody's doing the same thing.
Right.
So, you know, when we had the crash of 1987, we didn't have computerized trading, but we had computerized techniques being used in order to create a trading methodology, which meant as the market went down, you sell more. Now, that's a great way to protect one firm, but when many firms do it all at once, you end up going over-correcting and creating a crash. So those are the kinds of things that I think really need to be studied more, how all of these algorithms interact with one another. It's not obvious when you test any one.
Right.
Are these things, do they have a larger social benefit, or is there a larger social concern? Obviously, making these fractions of pennies in a half a second is interesting to investors. Does it improve the value of the goods and services that are theoretically produced by the companies?
Without question. Of course, you know, when we talk about institutional trading, we often think it doesn't affect us. But our state pension fund, for example, is an institutional investor, as are anybody who has life insurance, all of the pension funds that are out there. That's really who wins and who loses if things go well or things go poorly. So the fact that trading costs, I remember when I first started trading stocks maybe 40 years ago, it could cost as much as 2% of the stock. And of course, that meant people traded less because you had to really justify getting in or out at that level. In the last 10 years, trading costs have come down by almost a half, from about 7% all the way down to about 3.5%.
I want to thank
all. So that benefits everyone.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Alex Arapoglou is a professor of the practice of finance at the Kenan Flagler Business School at UNC Chapel Hill. Mike Aguilar is a lecturer in the economics department at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And Richard Warr, professor of finance in the Poole College of Management at North Carolina State. Coming up next, we will talk about the malign hand of the free market with Duke psychology professor John Stadden. Stay with us on the State of Things.